Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And it is my honor to welcome today Pentagon spokesman John Kirby, a retired United States Navy Rear Admiral who served in this role before during the Obama administration. He was also Chief of Naval Information and a former CNN military analyst. John, thanks very much for joining us. It's a real pleasure.
Great to be back with you, Vago. Enjoying it.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. We know how incredibly busy you are. You joined Secretary Austin on the administration's big push into Asia, visiting Japan, South Korea, as well as India. Austin was in Japan and South Korea with Secretary of State Tony Blinken, who then went on to Anchorage, where he met with, where he joined National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan for their meeting with Chinese officials. What were some of the messages Secretary Austin delivered across the region, John, and what were some of the key messages he received?
I mean, the big messages were really about the importance of alliances and partnerships, Vago. And when you look at everywhere we went, Japan, South Korea, India, while India is not a treaty ally, we certainly consider them a major strategic defense partner. It was really all about shoring up these partnerships and these alliances in a critical part of the world. The other thing that he wanted to do on this trip was really to listen and learn, to get a better sense of the neighborhood from their perspective, what they're seeing, what are the challenges that they're facing. Clearly, the PRC was on everybody's mind. As he traveled throughout the region. And as you know, he has said very clearly that China is the pacing challenge for the department. And so as he gets ready to work on the budget for the next year, as he gets ready to revise the national defense strategy, this was a very important trip to just sort of give him some foundational understandings about where the challenges are in the region, what the threats are, and what, just as importantly, what concepts and capabilities we at the department need to better formulate to deal with those challenges.
Absolutely right. I mean, everything is a key learning experience. And even though he's thought about some of these things before, it's certainly important to be there firsthand and have some of these conversations. Anchorage was a little bit messy, depending on how you look at it. But I think the U.S. side is getting credit for giving back as good as it got. Generally, the Chinese use these as rhetorical examples, and we tend to be patient and diplomatic. But all eyes are on U.S. actions in the Pacific, right? We remember the Pacific pivot, where some in the region said, hey, this was great rhetoric, but it was all about deliverables. The Indo-Pacific commander, Admiral Phil Davidson, has been driving the message of urgency that we have a very small window, perhaps 6 years or less, if we're going to continue deterring China from moving on Taiwan. John, does Secretary Austin share that sense of urgency? And what are some of the hard actions, right? You know, rhetoric is great, but what are some of the hard actions the region is going to see from the United States to support its allies and partners?
Well, look, I would tell you, the Secretary is certainly concerned at the significant changes that are taking place in the PRC's strategic forces. And he's likewise concerned about the lack of transparency coming from Beijing. So I think one of the things, and he made this clear, is that he would like to see greater transparency from the PRC's leadership with regard to both their intentions and their plans for modernization of these strategic forces. I think we all understand, while we don't understand perfectly what their intentions are, we certainly have been watching with continued alarm at the way in which they are pursuing and fielding capabilities, which clearly appear to be designed to make our freedom of maneuver in international air and water space more difficult.
But he shares that sense of urgency that we need to be moving and adjusting our forces accordingly, right? I mean, the administration has launched a whole series of studies. I know the Deputy Defense Secretary, Kath Hicks, is intimately involved in that process, as is the Secretary. Is there a sense from the Secretary that it's time now for major muscle movements? A little bit like our British allies did, take a little bit of risk now, make some of those hard choices to build the capabilities for the future. Is there that sense that you're up against the ticking clock and it's time to move?
We've got a global posture review ongoing that should wrap up by midsummer. And that global posture review will certainly include the Indo-Pacific region. And I don't want to get ahead of that process, Vago, but clearly one of the things that the Secretary wants to come out of this posture review is a sense of where our resources are, how well are they, are we equipped, how well are we trained in all around the world. And I suspect he'll be asking his experts the same questions about the Indo-Pacific. I would also add that he's already stood up a China task force here at the Pentagon that will both inform the posture review and be informed by it, that will help us sort of gather our thinking around what strategies we need to put in place, what capabilities are going to be the most valuable for us to put into the field and into the fleet. And that task force is up and running right now. So I don't want to get ahead of decisions that haven't been made, but it's, you know, the Indo-Pacific region is very much on the top of his priority list. And that's, I think, evident by the fact that his first overseas trip was in fact to the region.
And we heard from Admiral Lung Aquilino, the Pacific Fleet commander who's been nominated to become to replace Admiral Davidson when he retires. And he had made this point that the Chinese won military action over Taiwan, unfortunately, right? It's a matter of when and less a matter of if on that. Let me ask you about filling out the administration. There was an anticipation that the administration would fill out very, very rapidly and sort of hit the decks hard. That's not to say that you guys haven't been moving. I think you've been putting in pretty long days at the end of the day, as has been the secretary and the team there. And I should say that the special assistants are in. But I think it's also clear, talking to folks who are involved in the process, that it's not moving as fast as people would like it to, or everybody understands it needs to move. How long do you think it's going to be before you guys have some of these key political jobs staffed up? Because at the end of the day, they're absolutely key to driving the kind of changes that you're talking about.
Yeah, no question. These are important jobs, and we want to make sure we get it right. We want to make sure that we have the right people in place in these positions. And while the secretary certainly looks forward to getting leadership in place as soon as possible, he doesn't want to move faster than what's appropriate for getting the right people in place. So it's a balance, and we're not going to rush here to put people in seats. He wants to do this the right way. He wants to choose the best talent to help advise him and to help administer the department. We've got out of the 350 or so total vacancies to fill here at the Pentagon, we've gotten just under a third of that in place. Now, a lot of them, of the Senate confirmed jobs right now, there's only two. There's the secretary and the deputy secretary. So we know there's some work to do there. But again, the secretary is more focused on getting the right people in for these important jobs than he is in terms of, you know, rushing to get them filled. We've got some very qualified, very experienced acting officials right now that are doing terrific work, and he's grateful for that.
And I just a shout out, right? You guys also have a lot of special assistant, both young and experienced talent in some of these jobs to make sure that that valuable work keeps getting done.
The other thing I'd say to this, Vago, the other thing that's important, I don't mean to interrupt you, but he very much understands the importance of, you know, civilian control here of the department, and he wants to use the existing civilian chain of command as much as possible. So you talked about special assistants, and yes, there are some, and we continue to onboard them, just about every week or so, there's additional people coming in. But the secretary is really keen on using the actual civilian chain of command here at the Pentagon, and not pushing outside that norm that should be observed here at the Defense Department.
Right. I want to take you to Afghanistan. Obviously, the administration does want to wrap up, right? I mean, an area where there is a little bit of consistency between the Trump and the Biden administrations, although the administration has said that the May 1 deadline is likely not going to stand as there is that global force posture reconsideration. But A message sent to one ally and partner, as you know, can have a ripple effect on the other side of the world. For example, an unenforced red line in Syria, when you were on the, not to bring up a nightmare scenario from years past, right, did have ripple effects over in Asia. And there are some who are looking, are very encouraged by the Biden administration and its embrace of allies and partners and a much more conventional way of doing business. But at the same time, some eyebrows were raised at the really tough stance that Secretary of State Blinken has taken toward our Afghan allies. And there are folks who are saying that, look, I mean, it just sends a discordant global message. Does it send a discordant message? And given that Secretary Austin has such deep experience in the region, how is this likely to play out, right? Because the last time we made an abrupt departure, for example, in Iraq, we having to go back in a much more complicated and delicate military operation.
Well, listen, I won't speak for the Secretary of State or the communications that he's had in diplomatic channels. That wouldn't be our place. I can only speak to two things. One, there is an ongoing review process for Afghanistan right now, as well as a review of the Doha agreement that was negotiated by the previous administration. Those reviews are ongoing. No decisions have been made about Afghan policy at this point. Certainly no decisions have been made about troop posture. Everybody's aware of the May 1 deadline that's coming up, but the administration wants to think this through thoughtfully and deliberately, and I'm certainly not going to do anything that's going to steal decision space away from them in terms of speculation about what that might be. The secretary did meet with President Ghani when we were in Kabul just the day before yesterday. It was a good, frank, honest conversation. He has, as you noted, long relationships there in Afghanistan from his time both serving in combat but also as the Central Command commander. And that was evident in the very candid and, in fact, very cordial conversation that he had with the president and the vice president of Afghanistan. They had a chance to express their views and their perspectives of the situation on the ground, and the secretary went, as he said to the press afterward, he really went not to deliver a message, but to listen to them, to listen to that perspective, and to allow that perspective to inform his participation in this review process, and to inform the advice that he's going to give the president of the United States.
John, deterrence depends on military capability as well as political will. The department obviously is working on, you know, as you've said, the number of reviews that are ongoing to shape those kind of capabilities. But there are a lot of folks who are saying that if you're Chinese and a Chinese strategist, you have to look at an absolutely fractured political environment and wonder how that plays into the strategic calculus of folks in Beijing. Can the Pentagon keep deterring China alone without sort of that kind of unity at a political level to demonstrate to our adversaries that when it comes to foreign threats, the U.S. leadership is united? I mean, is you know, what else needs to happen? I mean, is that something that undermines military deterrence? And what else has to happen to sort of bring everybody together on this issue? Because it seems like the level of division would constitute itself a strategic threat to the nation.
Well, I certainly can't speak for how the Chinese think about electoral politics here in the United States. All I can speak for is this administration's approach to strategic deterrence and where the secretary wants to be, and he wants to focus on this very, very keenly. If you look back at his Senate Armed Services Committee confirmation hearing, he talked quite a bit about deterrence. It was certainly top of the list of things to talk about when we were in the region just this past week. And deterrence has to be backed up. Good, you know, effective deterrence has to be backed up by capabilities and operational concepts and resources. As the secretary says, we need resources matched to strategy, strategy matched to policy, and policy matched to the will of the American people. This gets to your political will that you raised. We recognize it's a thread all the way from political will all the way down to resources and assets, what you have, where you have it, and how much of it you have. All of that helps add to effective deterrence. And what the Secretary is trying to do in this global posture review is look at strategic deterrence around the world, not just aimed at one country or even just in one region, but how well are we postured to prevent conflict from breaking out? It's about deterring it. That's the first goal. Of course, you want, if you have to fight, you want to win. And so you got to make sure you've got the capabilities to do that. But the Secretary really wants to put a lot of energy as well into that, into front-loading deterrence. And that's going to be a key part of the global posture review that he's undertaking.
Let me ask you on your efforts to restore effective communications, right? I mean, one of the important things, you've always been throughout your career very available as a spokesperson. You did the same thing when you went over in the State Department in terms of being sure that there was an active voice on that. And this is particularly important in an environment where, regrettably, we're disinformation, right? I mean, a large portion of the American population believe things that are absolutely untrue, and it's extremely destabilizing and dangerous. For example, you know, it's impacting people's interest in taking vaccines, for example. What's your goal in terms of reshaping the Pentagon's communications capabilities to be able to deliver honest, open, transparent information to the American people?
I think it's vital that we actually live up to the principles of information that are literally written on the wall outside my office. There's not a day that I come to work where I don't walk past them and take a look at them and try to drink them in. We have an obligation to be as forthcoming and transparent with the American people around the world as we possibly can be. We also have an opportunity to do that. So what I'm trying to do is simply meet the obligation that we have, and the Secretary has made it clear to me that that's what he wants me to do, to be as honest and forthcoming as we can be, as transparent as we can be. But I also want to take a look at the opportunity to communicate. One of the great myths about communications is that you've actually done it. People think that, well, if I give a speech or I give an interview or I send a tweet, then I've communicated. And you don't think about whether the message sent was actually received and taken on board and understood in the same context with which you felt you delivered it. And so I do have tremendous capabilities here in DOD through the services and through their public affairs shops, but also through defense media activity and the Defense Information School, our schoolhouse for young communicators. And I now have an opportunity to take a look at all those capabilities, you know, back to capabilities and resources, and see if we're really taking full advantage of the opportunity we have to really communicate in real time with people and to understand, you know, back to what, you know, John Marshall, once the Supreme Court Chief Justice, once said that the most important part of communicating is listening, to make sure that we're also listening, that communications is two-way. I don't like it when people say our job is to tell our story. Our job is to share our story, and that means listening as well and taking feedback in. And I do want to take a look at the degree to which the department is postured to actually live in that real world conversation that's going on all around us.
And what about the fight against disinformation, right? I mean, we're in an environment where I think we can all agree it's extraordinary the nature of mistruths and how they spread. What's the role of the department? I mean, how do you guys fight that? Because that affects, right, the ranks as well, right? The military is a reflection of society. So if a portion of society believes a certain thing, it gets reflected in the military. What's the role you can play there?
There's a couple of thoughts here. Number one is the power of story. I mean, one of the reasons why disinformation is so powerful is because it makes you angry. And if you're seeing a headline and you're looking at something on social media and it really fires you up and lathers you up, you got to take another look and just check the sourcing. Because that's one of the things that disinformation does. The other thing it does, and because there's such an emotional pull, one of the ways to combat that, you can't just combat disinformation with with facts. Facts are important. Facts are integral to the effort. Because we can't lie, have to hold ourselves to truth and to facts. But we also need to nestle those facts and that truth inside story. And one of the things I want to make sure we're doing here at the department is sharing our stories, making these policies and these initiatives and these operations, make them human, show them through human eyes, because that will help us beat back the emotional content that you see so much in the disinformation space. But look, I mean, Mark Twain said it best, a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still tying on its shoes. Today, because of social media, because the information environment is so instantaneously pervasive, we can't even find our shoes before the lie has traveled halfway around the world, much less tie them up. And so we've got to be more fleet of foot in that space. We can't be afraid to be reactive. You're never going to beat a lie. You're never going to beat a lie to the punch. It's all because if you're not holding yourselves to the truth, you can say anything you want in time you want. We can't beat it out there, but we can certainly overcome it with good, solid, truthful information and story over time. And that means a couple of things, Vago. It means being more visual. We have to understand the power of imagery. It is imagery, really, that moves people and affects people more than words. And number two, it's repetition. We have to, you know, once you've got that message, once you've got that story, you got to keep telling it over and over again. Even when you think you've told it too much, keep telling it, because through repetition and imagery, you can overcome a lot of the bad information that's out there. You're not going to beat it. You're never going to get out there first with it, or not never, but you're very likely not going to beat it, but you can overcome it.
John, thank you so very much. Fair Winds Following Seas. Look forward to welcoming you back on again, and keep up the good fight. Thanks very much, sir.
Thanks, Vago. Always good to be with you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.